From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. We're ending the year with a series called Last Laughs, featuring some of our most entertaining interviews of 2004. On today's Fresh Air, two people behind kids' shows that are so smart and funny, they developed big adult audiences. First, the voice of SpongeBob, Tom Kenny. He's a comic as well as voice artist. He's done voices for Powerpuff Girls, Futurama, Johnny Bravo, and CatDog. He'll talk with us in some of his many voices. Then, a trip through Pee-wee's Playhouse with Paul Reubens. All 45 episodes of the series are now out on DVD. It was broadcast Saturday mornings from 1986 to 91 and won 22 Emmys. We'll talk with Paul Reubens about creating Pee-wee and what his own childhood was like. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. At least 8 Americans are among the more than 23,000 people who've been killed by the massive earthquake-generated waves that slammed into coastal areas of Asia. The White House says the United States will be a leading partner in what it called one of the most significant relief, rescue, and recovery challenges the world has ever known. Secretary of State Colin Powell says the U.S. has already earmarked nearly $4.5 million to relief efforts. NPR's Michelle Kellerman has more.
Officials expect to give another $10 million in emergency relief, and Powell said the U.S. is preparing for the longer haul.
Some 20-plus thousand lives have been lost in a few moments, but the lingering effects will be there for years.
A top United Nations official estimated the damage in the many billions of dollars and said he hasn't been able to reach some of his staff in Indonesia. Secretary Powell said embassy officials in the region are trying to locate hundreds of Americans who are still unaccounted for. The U.S. Navy has sent 3 surveillance aircraft to survey affected countries. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
Iraqi police say a suicide bomber was apparently trying to assassinate the leader of a major Shiite political party today during an attack that killed 15 people in Baghdad. They say the bomber tried to ram his car through the gate at the home of Abdulaziz al-Hakim, but was blocked by guards. Al-Hakim is the head of the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq. Police say al-Hakim was at home but wasn't hurt. The explosion wounded at least 50 people. In an audio tape broadcast on the Arabic television station Al Jazeera, a man purporting to be Osama bin Laden has endorsed a Jordanian terrorist in Iraq as his deputy. NPR's Lourdes Garcia Navarro reports from Baghdad.
The voice on the tape referred to Abu Musab al-Zarqawi as the prince of al-Qaeda in Iraq and called on Muslims to listen to him. Al-Zarqawi's group is believed responsible for a number of car bombings and beheadings of foreign hostages here. In a recent statement, al-Zarqawi declared his allegiance to bin Laden. The speaker on this tape said al-Zarqawi and those with him are fighting for God's sake and accepted the pledge. The voice also called for a boycott of next month's elections here, saying, quote, everyone who participates in this election will be considered infidels. This is the second tape reportedly made by bin Laden to surface this month. The authenticity of this tape has not been confirmed. A State Department spokesman said, though, that this was a, quote, message from terrorists in an attempt to propagate their evil trade. Lourdes Garcia Navarro, NPR News, Baghdad.
A spokesman for Connecticut Governor Jody Rell says she'll be in the hospital for about 3 days after undergoing surgery for breast cancer. The governor's office says the cancer was discovered after a routine mammogram and was caught at a very early stage. In stocks, the Dow lost 51 to close at 10,776. In light trading, the Nasdaq was down 6 to 2154. This is NPR News. Regional airline Comair hopes to resume full service by midweek after a computer malfunction grounded most flights during the busy Christmas weekend. Mike Savage reports from Georgia Public Broadcasting.
Thousands of passengers had to scramble to get rerouted to their destinations after a computer failure forced the cancellation of all 1,100 Comair flights Saturday. The airline has added some flights, but doesn't expect to be fully operational until at least Wednesday. Comair is run by Atlanta-based Delta and has its main hub at Cincinnati Northern Kentucky International Airport. The company said the computer that manages the airline's flight assignments failed Friday night after it could not handle cancellations and delays caused by a winter storm in the Ohio Valley. Comair serves about 30,000 customers in 118 cities. Officials do not know how many people were affected by the computer glitch. The company said technicians are working quickly to resolve the problem. For NPR News, I'm Mike Savage in Atlanta.
International election observers say yesterday's presidential runoff vote in Ukraine was a great step forward to free and fair elections. Initial results show opposition leader Viktor Yushchenko with an 8.5% lead over Prime Minister Viktor Yanukovych. Yushchenko's supporters celebrated his apparent victory by dancing all night in the main square of Kyiv, the Ukrainian capital. Yanukovych has not yet conceded the election, but he did say yesterday that he was prepared to lead a new opposition movement if he lost. Yesterday's vote was a rerun of the presidential vote that was thrown out by the Ukrainian Supreme Court because of widespread vote fraud by Yanukovych's government. In stocks, the S&P 500 lost 5 points to close at 1,204. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo USA, investing in America by providing jobs and career opportunities for more than 100,000 Americans. Online at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we begin our week-long series, Last Laughs, featuring some of our most entertaining interviews of the year.
Can I help you with something, sir?
Name's Dennis. I've been hired to exterminate you.
You're gonna exterminate us?
SpongeBob and his dim-witted starfish friend Patrick face a hitman, voiced by Alec Baldwin, in the SpongeBob SquarePants movie. This animated film is based on the SpongeBob SquarePants TV series, which is set at the bottom of the ocean and stars a sea sponge that looks like a kitchen sponge, along with his sea creature buddies and sea monster foes. The series premiered on Nickelodeon in 1999 and has been the number one kid show on broadcast and cable TV for almost 3 years. Tom Kenny does the voice of SpongeBob and several minor characters. He's also a stand-up comic. He's done voices for Cat Dog, Rocko's Modern Life, Futurama, Johnny Bravo, and Powerpuff Girls. He was a cast member on HBO's sketch comedy series, Mr. Show. I spoke with Tom Kenny last month when the SpongeBob SquarePants movie opened. Tom Kenny, welcome to Fresh Air. Let me ask you to describe SpongeBob for someone who's never seen the cartoon.
Oh, wow, yeah. SpongeBob SquarePants is a little square kitchen sponge, even though he was born of sea sponges. It's kind of an accident of nature. But he lives in a pineapple under the sea, works in a fast food restaurant called the Krusty Krab in the undersea community of Bikini Bottom. What else can I tell you? He pals around with an incredibly dim starfish named Patrick Star, has a crabby neighbor named Squidward Tentacles who lives in a giant tiki head next door to him. He's incurably optimistic and enthusiastic and kinetic and he has a cartoon show on Nickelodeon.
Now, if you're doing a voice for, say, a cartoon animal, you know, animals make noises, so you can maybe base your voice on like a cat's meow or a dog's bark or, you know, a bear's growl or something. If you're doing the voice of a human character, humans really speak. If you're doing the voice of a sponge, there's really like nothing in nature to base that on. So how did you figure out what voice you wanted to use?
Which is actually very freeing in a way because there's no template. So, it's kind of a wide open road. But when it came time to come up with a voice, it was just a matter of finding a voice that was childlike and maybe childish, but not a child, non-age specific, enthusiastic, and just kind of weird. And we've finally settled on this elfish helium
voice that SpongeBob wound up being.
And, you know, this weird, you know, that was the fun part, was before it was even a pitch or even a show, and we were just, you know, sitting in coffee shops, irritating people at other tables, going, you know, what would he laugh like? What would his laugh be like? And, you know, how about a dolphin? How about kind of like a dolphin? Like Flipper used to. Yeah, that's good. And you know, it was really a blast.
Now, the movie, the SpongeBob movie, is kind of a musical. There's a bunch of songs in it. You sing a couple. And one of the songs you sing in the movie is called The Best Day Ever. Before we hear it, can you talk a little bit about what it's like to sing in character?
Yeah, some voices really lend themselves to singing, And even though I didn't really think about it ahead of time, it's just serendipitous that
SpongeBob did. It's pretty easy to sing in that voice. La 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 la. My dog has fleas.
But, you know, there are other voices that I've done where I'm just so glad I don't have to sing in them. You know, if you're doing that guy, there's not a lot of there's not a lot of Sondheim-like range that you can tap into. But yeah, SpongeBob really, really is fun to sing as. It's sort of like a weird mix between, you know, Jerry Lewis and the guy from the schlock 70s band Styx. You know, it's kind of...
Babe, I'm leaving, must be on my way.
It's very weird.
Where do you place that voice in your head?
I would have to say that if I were going to draw a circle around the target area, it would be somewhere between my fairly sizable proboscis and and my thorax.
It's definitely up in the nasal cavity, back of the throat area, and Bill Fagerbakke, that does the voice of, or it's Fagerbakke or Fagerbakke. He's never told me how to pronounce his name. He says, whatever. I'm not fuzzy. Whatever. But, you know, his voice as Patrick is just
all pushed down right into his big barrel chest.
And then SpongeBob is way up here.
So it's kind of a neat contrast between SpongeBob and Patrick Starfish.
Well, Tom Kenny, let's hear you sing. And this is from the soundtrack of the SpongeBob SquarePants movie. And here's Tom Kenny singing The Best Day Ever, a song you co-wrote.
Yes, I did, with Andy Paley, power pop meister.
Okay, here it comes. That's Tom Kenny, the voice of SpongeBob and the star of the SpongeBob SquarePants movie. So you actually wrote The Best Day Ever, which we just heard. Tell us something about your approach to writing a song for SpongeBob to sing.
You know, it was this really fun mental exercise where my friend Andy Paley and I, and you know, if you Google Andy Paley, it's insane. He's produced records by Jerry Lee Lewis and, you know, Brian Wilson and, you know, all these people. But it was very freeing to just put on SpongeBob's brain and say, wow, well, SpongeBob is this unbridled optimist. He jumps out of bed every day and greets the new day with the mantra,
this is going to be the best day ever.
You know, every day has the potential to be the best day ever, which is, you know, how we'd all like to be. And then by the time we walk out the front door, we're beaten into submission by life. But yeah, it was really fun. And we tried to make the song sound like, you know, we were trying to figure out who in rock and roll history has been most in touch with their inner SpongeBob. And, you know, and it's John Sebastian from The Lovin' Spoonful. You know, he is SpongeBob. Do you believe in magic? You know, Brian Wilson, who will write like this beautiful 4-minute opus about the wind chimes. These are my wind chimes. You know, and it's like, well, you know, they sort of have this naif-like child man sort of sensibility that is SpongeBob. So it's like, let's write a Lovin' Spoonful, Brian Wilson, Pet Sounds, you know, sort of thing with SpongeBob singing it. And that's where Best Day Ever came from.
Now, you do the voices of several other characters, smaller characters, in the SpongeBob movie. Tell us about some of those characters and the voices you came up with.
Oh, gosh. Let's see. I've always done, you know, SpongeBob has a pet sea snail named Gary that meows like a cat for reasons that are never explained on the show. And I think just because I was around early on, I've been meowing for Gary for 5 seasons. Meow! 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 And they still record all his meows. I go, you guys have to have a library of every type of meow imaginable. Why are we still recording the meow? And there's also
There's a French narrator that sounds a lot like Jacques Cousteau, and now we see the beautiful manta ray as he swims.
And Jacques Cousteau is a great hero of Steve Hillenburg's, and rather than have the usual kind of booming stentorian narrator that you'd see on a cartoon, we decided to have the action occasionally be moved along by this really, you know, flatliner Jacques Cousteau type guy.
3 days later, we find SpongeBob SquarePants, and he's, you know,
it's just kind of bizarre choice. And then there's an on-camera kiddie show host that occasionally appears in live action on the show,
named Patsy the Pirate, that is also me, who's got like this sort of chintzy, cheap kids show where he shows SpongeBob cartoons.
So when I see that character, I am seeing you.
That's me. Well, you're seeing me with like a patch and a beard
and a wig,
a
maybe,
hat and a wig, definitely a wig. Yeah, Patsy's a fun character to do because he's based on, you know, that local kiddie show host that we all had in our hometown in the 60s that showed Popeye cartoons and Betty Boop cartoons and whatnot, that, you know, everybody had that guy. In my hometown of Syracuse, New York, it was Salty Sam. He had a show called Salty Sam's Showboat. And, you know, he was a sailor character that showed Popeye cartoons and, you know, would hold up drawings that kids sent in. And it was just this neat vanished world of kid programming that's not around anymore in the ultra slick current day. And you know, everybody that we talked to on the show had that guy in their hometown.
So what were the cartoons you grew up with on Salty Sam's?
Oh man, I was obsessed with Popeye the Sailor Man as a kid. I think, I don't know, 6 or 7 Halloweens in a row, I was Popeye the Sailor Man, which, you know, is a pitch that probably would not fly now. You know, you go into the big Cartoon Network and go, okay, he's a sailor, and his eye has been poked out, and he likes to punch people. What do you think, you know? But
And the real thing is he eats spinach.
He eats spinach, and wow, then he gets strong, and this enables him to punch people harder and beat them up more completely. What do you think? But it was Popeye the Sailor Man, and it was a particular honor for me when SpongeBob and Popeye shared a cover of TV Guide, as they did a series of covers featuring the top 50 cartoon characters ever, and they had a cover drawing that was Popeye the Sailor Man drawing his anchor up out of the water, and it's caught on SpongeBob's underwear, and he's just kind of hanging off the anchor looking at Popeye. It was a weird kind of, I don't know, like full circle cosmic moment for me.
So when you were a kid and you loved Popeye, did you do the Popeye voice and that kind of Popeye mumble that he's always doing as he's walking and thinking?
I loved that. Yeah, that thing that Jack Mercer, the voice of Popeye, you know, he was Popeye for 80 years or something. You know, he was incredible. And I also loved the Looney Tunes, you know, Bugs and Daffy, of course, and, you know, Bullwinkle and Rocky were huge for me. And even those early Hanna-Barbera cartoons like Yogi Bear and Huckleberry Hound and Top Cat, you know, they had, even when the animation was fairly limited, the voice work was really great. And from a really early age, I was conscious of the fact that there were grown men whose job it was to help bring these things to life. And it seemed like a really fun job to me. I had an aunt, a very hep aunt, who, when I was a kid, gave me a bunch of Stan Freberg record albums, like History of the United States and all that. And they had little biographies of the voice actors on the back of the album, like, you know, Stan Freberg, June Foray, Dawes Butler, you know, people like that. And they were amazing. I was very aware that there was a guy named Mel Blanc whose name was on every cartoon. But, you know, pre-internet... In the pre-internet world, it was kind of hard to find out about that stuff. You had to sort of feel your way around, but that only made it more kind of mysterious. You know, I liked to, I don't know, I felt like there was this whole hidden world of cartoons and voice acting that needed to be uncovered by me.
My guest is Tom Kenny, the voice of SpongeBob. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
My guest is Tom Kenny. He does the voice of SpongeBob in the Nickelodeon series and the movie. So did you have a sense when you were a kid that you wanted to be a voice actor?
I did, yeah, I did. And by the time I was a teenager, it was firmly in place. In fact, one of my best friends from first grade on is the comedian Bobcat Goldthwait. And we met in first grade and you know, are still close at 42 years old or whatever. And he reminded me recently of a conversation that he and I had in high school, like just kind of, you know, kind of walking around your hometown where there's no show business and playing this game of whose career do you want? If you could have anybody's career in show business, who would you want? And this was probably 76 or 78. And Bob reminded me of this conversation we had had where he said John Belushi and I said Mel Blanc. And he said, wow, isn't that weird that you sort of did it. You're doing the same kind of work that Mel Blanc did. And I said, yeah, that is weird.
I don't know how Bobcat Goldthwait still manages to have a voice because the voice that he does sounds like it would just rip up your vocal cords.
Yeah, I know. I don't either. He has vocal cords of steel. But yeah, he's we met in first grade. We went to the same Catholic school, but we were in separate first grades. And the first time I became aware of Bob was when the nun that taught his classroom just dragged him by the ear into the nun that taught my classroom, and his nun was crying. And she just threw him into the classroom and said, I can't take him anymore, sister. You have to. This Goldthwait boy. And I said, whoa, I have to get to know this boy who can make a grown nun cry. It was really bizarre. And so him and I, he was the only other kid that had an interest in that left field kind of, you know, stand up and sketch comedy. And when SCTV came on the air, it totally blew our minds. And we went to see Andy Kaufman perform in Syracuse when we were. And, you know, it was cool to have another person who was into that stuff. So you knew that you weren't crazy. Because, again, now, you know, a kid can get on the internet and just, you know, immediately be in touch with, you know, how many hundreds of like-minded square pegs. But, you know,
it wasn't that way back in the 70s. We had to find other nerds to talk to. Ourselves.
There's one really funny memory I have. You know, Bob was the quintessential fat kid that was the class clown. And I was the quintessential shy, skinny kid who didn't have the guts to be class clown, but considered himself the class clown's head writer. You know, I mean, hey, try this during math class, Bob. It'll work for you. You know, that's a good sound. Try that one. But, you know, I have a great memory of us in gym class, and they were picking teams for basketball. And, of course, Bob and I were both just hopeless at sports. And, you know, funny as a defense mechanism, that old chestnut. And it came down, they were picking teams, and everyone got picked except Bob and myself and this little girl who had a hook for a hand. And Bob and I just look at each other, and the captain of the other team says, I'll take Susie. And she walked, the girl with the hook for the hand walked over to play hoops. And Bob and I just looked at each other and just started laughing. You know, these like, you know, fourth graders just laughing our heads off at how stupid and hopeless we were. Even now, I can't explain how, you know, how perfect that moment was, where it's just you and your other nerdy friend and the girl with the hook, and the girl with the hook goes off to play basketball, and they're going, yeah, Tom and Bob, it doesn't really matter what team they're on. They're just there to make us laugh anyway.
How did you break into voice work?
You know, fortuitously, I was doing stand-up one night at the now-defunct Improv in Santa Monica, and there was a person from Nickelodeon and also a person from what was then Hanna-Barbera in the audience, and they both approached me the same night, and said it was a showcase, and they said, geez, have you ever thought about doing animated voices for cartoons? And I said, you know, maybe every day of my life, perhaps. Where do I sign? And yeah, it was great. I really felt like, you know, once I did the first couple of them, the first one or two were extremely terrifying, and then I felt like I had just found this suit that fit me so well. It was like, wow, this is what I was looking for. You know, this feels even much better and righter to me than stand-up does.
Do you ever get recognized by your voice, since you don't really use your real voice in your work?
No, actually, this is a character that I'm doing right now. This is, this is really hard for me to do right now. No, my real voice is kind of uninteresting and vanilla and, you know, nasal, you know, Syracuse accent. And if I wasn't able to twist it into various shapes, you know, I'd be working in a store. Like, I see guys like James Earl Jones, and they've got the voice. They've got that voice, and it's what they do. And it's a, you know, it's a gold mine. It's a, you know, if I say Darth Vader's lines, it doesn't have the same it doesn't have the same cachet. Hey, I find your lack of faith disturbing. Okay, I must have those plans. But, you know, so you know, like the guy that does the trailers. Yo, in a world where a man's voice goes down at the end of every sentence, it's like wow, that guy really talks like that. I've run into that guy. That really is his voice. And he really does do the thing where he goes down, then. Like in promos, you listen to promos and you realize that it's all about the word then. You know, on a very special CSI Toledo, then, on Buffy. Then, on a very special Pretty People in Their 20s, cellulite is discovered on Sarah. With a, you know.
Have you really met that guy?
I have, yeah, man.
He gets a lot of work.
He's the guy. I mean, it's him. You walk around, you go, wow. Yes, I'm ready for my car now. It's like, I love it. You know, like, I can make fun of that, but I can't really do it.
Well, you just
you know?
Did it.
And you have to be able to reference the word masterpiece in illimitable ways, you know. It's been called a small masterpiece. Critics are calling it some kind of a masterpiece. It's being hailed as a masterpiece. It's like, wow, if everything's a masterpiece, that makes everything sort of generic.
Well, Tom Kenny, it's just been great talking with you. Thank you so much.
And thank you very much, Terry.
Tom Kenny does the voice of SpongeBob in the SpongeBob SquarePants movie and in the Nickelodeon series. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Now that we're men, we can do anything. Now that we're men, we are invincible. Now that we're men, we'll go to Chelsea, get the crown, save the town, and Mr. Krabs. Now that we're men, we have facial hair. Now that we're men,
I change my underwear.
Now that we're men, we got a manly flair. We got the stuff, we're top enough to save the day. We never had a chance when we were kids. No. Let's take a look at what the mermaids did.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publisher of Tree, a new vision of the American forest by photographer James Balog. Available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Bantam Books, publisher of Tool & Die, A Home Repair is Homicide Mystery by Sarah Graves, author of Mallets of Forethought. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Paul Rubens tells us how he created his alter ego, Pee-wee Herman, and talks about growing up near the headquarters of Ringling Brothers Circus as we continue our end-of-the-year retrospective, Last Laughs.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're ending the year with a series called Last Laughs, featuring some of our most entertaining interviews of 2004.
Hey, Pee-wee, do you know what time it is?
It's fun time! It's fun time!
Pee-wee's Playhouse, all five seasons, that's 45 episodes, has just been released on DVD. It was broadcast as a Saturday morning kid show from 1986 to 91, but its audience included a lot of adults, like me, who loved the humor, the characters, and the design. Our TV critic, David Bianculli, describes the DVD collection as packed with more entertainment and insanity per minute than any release this side of the Looney Tunes collections. We're going to talk with Paul Rubens about creating his alter ego, Pee-wee Herman. Rubens declined to talk about his past legal problems pertaining to charges of indecent exposure in a Florida adult theater and his collection of vintage erotica. Pee-wee's Playhouse had a great cast of characters. Even the inanimate objects were alive. The chair, the window, and the daisies on the windowsill could all talk. A puppet band of beatnik-style hipsters played jazz, sang, and talked in rhymes. The food in the refrigerator was alive. And in each episode, a robot-like boombox named Conky printed out a secret word.
Ready to assist you, Pee-wee.
Morning, Conky.
What's today's secret word?
Today's secret word is
good!
Now, you all know what to do whenever anybody says a secret word, right?
Scream! That's right.
For the rest of the day, if anybody says a secret word,
scream real loud. Ready? Let's try it.
Hey, guys, what are you doing?
Cool cats pounding out the beat.
And we're standing with our feet.
Like they're dancing, man.
I can dig it. Hey. Let me try rhyming.
Cool.
I'd talk like you do if I could.
Come on, Pee-wee, you're doing good.
A great big scream is what we heard.
I must have said the secret word.
This rhyming's fun, I agree, but now it's time to play with me.
Hey, Magic Screen, that was really good.
Let's hear the interview I recorded with Paul Rubens. I thought it was pretty good. Well, let's start at the very beginning of the birth of Pee-wee Herman. How did you first create the character? I think this was back in the Groundlings era when you were working with that improv comedy group.
Yeah, it was, I believe, 1977. I was three, and we were doing a night where we were kind of doing an extended scene, what we called an extended scene, and we were trying to do something where it was like a comedy club, like the Comedy Store or the Improv. We were all supposed to be different characters that you might see in a comedy club. So I decided to be the guy at the comedy club that everybody would like immediately know this guy was never going to make it as a comic. And part of it was because I couldn't remember jokes in real life. I couldn't remember the punchline, or I'd get halfway through the joke, and I was always the guy who'd be like, oh, wait, no, I forgot to tell you this part, you know? So that's, and that character just sort of came out that night. I mean, I borrowed a suit from the director of the Groundlings, Gary Austin. I borrowed his suit, which had been made for him by a guy named Mr. J, if he's out there listening. And, somebody else gave me a little tiny bow tie. I had a little one-inch-long harmonica that said Pee-wee on it. And I knew a kid whose last name was Herman. And Pee-wee Herman sounded like the kind of name you would never make up. It sounded like, you know, a totally real name, like made by somebody whose parents were, you know, didn't really care about them.
So, well, let's talk about the creation of the Saturday morning version of Pee-wee's Playhouse.
Okay.
Let's start with your voice, since you're speaking to us on the radio. Obviously, you didn't use your regular voice for the character of Pee-wee. How did you arrive at that kind of high and laughy voice that you created?
You know, I had been doing, years before the creation of Pee-wee Herman, I was I worked at a theater that was the State Theater of Florida called the Oslo Theater, which is still in existence, still a fantastic place, which was in my hometown, Sarasota, Florida. and was based at the John and Mabel Ringling Museum of Art, which Sarasota, as you may or may not know, was the former headquarters of the winter headquarters of the Ringling Brothers Circus. So there's a lot of Ringling influence there. And I had been doing Life with Father in repertory with a bunch of other shows. And my character, I was the second oldest son, not the star son, but the second banana son. And over a three-month period, and I'm not bragging about this, this probably wasn't a good thing, but my character developed into this total cartoon character. And I didn't really even realize it, but, you know, 3 months down the line, somebody said, wow, do you remember what you were originally doing and what you're doing now? And I was like, wow, that's it is really different. So the voice came from that. That is Pee-wee's voice. It was from, you know, good morning, mother, you know, blah, blah, blah. And that became Pee-wee's voice.
So
I love that story.
So from doing theater, you developed the voice for Pee-wee?
Yep. You sound incredulous.
Well, it sounds like it must have been pretty cartoony by the time it was done.
It was. It was pretty cartoony.
How did that happen? Did you not like the play?
You know, I don't know. No, I loved the play. I thought it was a really great play. I think I just wasn't very professional. I was an idiot. I didn't know what, you know, I didn't know you weren't supposed to, like, change it completely into a cartoon. It was unwitting. Unwittingly? I did it unwittingly, Jerry.
My guest is Paul Rubens. All the episodes of Pee-wee's Playhouse have been released on DVD. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Paul Rubens, who's best known for his character Pee-wee Herman. All the episodes of Pee-wee's Playhouse are now out on DVD. Can we talk a little bit about the look of Pee-wee's Playhouse? It was just such a fantastic set of images. You know, bright colors, all kinds of like shapes, and everything was alive in it. You know, like the chair had arms that could embrace the person sitting in it, and the chair talked, and the window talked. How was the look designed, and were you a part of that?
Were you taking some kind of psychedelic drug when you watched that show? No, I'm just kidding, Terry. The look of the show really had a lot to do with an artist named Gary Panter, who designed the original stage version of it and designed much of was really the overall production designer. And created the look of the show, the television version of it. He was somebody who, when I was really creating that character in the early days of Pee-wee Herman, was kind of like the punk scene in Los Angeles. And he was kind of one of the premier, like, punk artists. And I had seen a lot of his work. He was in a publication called the LA Weekly.
And in Raw Magazine that Art Spiegelman edited.
Exactly. And I'd seen a lot of his work, and I loved his work. And I contacted him and asked him if he would do a poster for a show that I hadn't created yet. And he said, well, why don't I do the poster? And, well, actually, he said, let me come down and see what it is. So he came down and saw me in the Groundlings show, where I had my little 10-minute Pee-wee thing, and came backstage and said, I'd love to do it, but why don't I do the whole thing? Why don't I design the sets and the puppets and everything? And I said, yeah, great. So he designed that, and then when we got the deal with CBS a few years later to do it as a real television series, he came on board. He was the first person I hired and said, you know, you gotta do this set. So it was, the rest is history, I guess. But, I think it's probably the most amazing aspect of the show, in my opinion, is the design of it. It was just so startlingly incredible, in my opinion.
Now, you've said that one of the things you really loved about the character of Pee-wee Herman was that he showed that it was okay to be different. What did you feel was most different about you when you were growing up?
You know, I guess I felt like a total oddball all the, like almost every minute of growing up, so it'd be hard to kind of isolate that. But, I mean, I think that sort of was the whole point of the show, or at least a big point of the show, was that, like, you know, it would be hard to stand out in the Playhouse, you know? Like, everything stood out in the Playhouse. So you could sort of feel real right at home no matter who you are or what you were thinking or anything.
Tell us a little bit about what your childhood was like, where you grew up, and what your school years were like. Were you uncomfortable in school? Did you do well in school? Were you picked on?
Well, I grew up in an orphanage, and...
Oh, stop.
Oh, no, that was my fantasy character, sorry. I grew up in upstate New York, Oneonta, New York, until we moved in in between third and fourth grade, we moved, which was like a huge relief to me because Mrs. Lake that I had in third grade was really mean to me and scared the hell out of me as far as math goes. Like, I still to this day, if I got to add or subtract anything, I almost go into a coma. So we moved. So I had an incredible upbringing in upstate New York, which included the New York State Teachers College is in Oneonta, and there was a laboratory school that my sister and I went to. And we lived in a really small town where there was lots of nature and animals, and we had a little creek with a crabapple tree across the street. I'm going to burst into tears in a second. it was really like a very storybook kind of upbringing. And then we moved to Florida. And moving to Florida was, like, incredible. I thought we moved to Hawaii. I thought we were in the tropics or something. And my mother took us to go get back-to-school clothes. And I bought all these beachcomber outfits. So I showed up for the first day of school in fourth grade in Florida with, like, clam digger pants on and these nautical shirts and, like a total freak. And the kids at school were like, what are you supposed to be? And the thing that was funny about it in hindsight is, like, normally I'm in that kind of situation, I think the kids would probably, you would probably go like, oh, sorry, you know, I didn't know what it was. But me, I was totally like, don't you get it? You know, I'm a beachcomber. What's wrong with you guys? And instead, like, the next day, I, like, put out another variation of the same outfit and put it on and got back to school and was like, you know, these kids are going to come around or they're not, whatever, but I'm not changing.
Was this your theatrical impulse expressing itself?
I think it was, yeah, at a very early, early stage.
So when you moved to Sarasota, which you said was the winter headquarters for Ringling Brothers Circus, did you meet any circus people?
Oh, I met lots of circus people. I mean, for one thing, you could see the circus people coming down the street. You know, like the lady with the bright red hair and the wooden shoes, you know, would be obviously a circus person. I mean, you could just tell that they were very show business people in a very small town, a conservative small town. So you could tell who they were. We rented a little house the first year we moved to Sarasota, and we used to hear these explosions all the time. And we never could figure out what they were. And one day, a couple weeks after we moved, our whole family was walking. We took a walk one night after dinner. And we heard this explosion, and we looked in between these two homes. We saw somebody flying through the air in between these two homes. And it turned out that it was the Zucchini family. And they were the family with the giant silver cannon, and they were shooting each other out of the cannon in the backyard.
That's so
bizarre. And in fact, years later, when I made my circus movie, we went back to Sarasota and recreated that cannon.
For Big Top Pee Wee?
Yeah.
Wow.
Did you
want to be in the circus after seeing this?
I did. You know, I actually thought that if... I've been asked, like, what would have happened if you weren't successful as Pee Wee Herman? What would you have done? And I really thought I was headed for a career in the circus.
As
the pinheaded guy. No, the the unfunny guy. The guy who, I don't know, I knew how to walk a tightrope. I could do trapeze.
Could you really walk a tightrope?
Oh, yeah.
How'd you learn that?
I went to circus camp when I was young.
Really?
Mm-hmm. I swear.
And did you ever do the Circus Barker rap?
No, I never did that. I considered briefly covering my body with tattoos, but I didn't do that, which is a good thing now because, you know, everybody has that now,
that's
so
right.
It wouldn't really be, like, you know, it'd be sad if I did that. I did, like, I started out, I had a balance beam act. My parents showed up to circus camp when we were putting on the show, and I had on, like, a little Speedo bathing suit, and I'd get up on the balance beam with a blindfold on and, like, set these, like, rings on fire and do this insane, completely insane act. Like, look, I pulled the blindfold off and looked at my parents. They were both sitting up in the bleachers with their mouths open, like, what have we created? You know, like, totally. I think that was probably an early tip-off to them that I wasn't gonna be an architect.
So were you inhibited or extroverted as a kid?
One or the other?
Or something in between?
Honestly, I think I was probably a little of each. I was sort of skitsy when I was, like, a kid. I would be, like, very introverted and, in you know, up in my room by myself. And then I would be, like, the life of the party, you know, like, gathering all the kids around to, like, we had a little stage in our basement that my dad built me once he realized he was raising a little monster actor. So the kids in the neighborhood would come over and try to figure out, like, what was the teeniest part they could give me so they could use the stage. So we would do, like, these murder mysteries where, like, the opening of the show would be me getting pushed off stage into a vat of acid. And then I would be, like, you know, my part would be over. And then all the older kids would, like, do the show. It wasn't until later in life I realized, you know, I'd come in and go, like, you've met my attorney, right? Let's see. You know, talk to them.
What TV shows did you watch as a kid?
I was part of an early study on the effects of television on children when I was going to that school in upstate New York I mentioned. I remember being in first or second grade and having some scientists come into our class to ask us questions about, like, what shows we liked. And all the rest of the kids were like, Mickey Mouse Club and Howdy Doody. And my favorite show was I Love Lucy. And so I got, like, selected out of the whole class. I had to go in, you know, leave the office, leave the classroom and go to an office and listen to a bunch of scientists, like, go, like, well, what was it about the I Love Lucy show that that attracts you? And who do you like better, Lucy or Desi or Ethel or Fred? And, you know, I was, like, in second grade. I didn't know any. I just thought, like, well, I like the show just because I like the show. That's a long way to answer. I didn't even answer your question. I watched, in addition to I Love Lucy, when I was really young, I watched, I loved the Mickey Mouse Club. I loved Captain Kangaroo, and I loved Howdy Doody. I was even on the Howdy Doody show. My mother drove me and my sister to New York, and we were on the Howdy Doody show.
In the Peanut Gallery?
Mm-hmm. Somebody knows the Howdy Doody show. Good. Impressive.
What was it like to be inside rather than watching it on the TV?
Very confusing. I remember my sister was so freaked out. She burst into tears right before the show, and she had to be, like, put in an isolation booth. She didn't make it. She didn't make it on the air. But I did. I was like, oh, after this drive, you got to be kidding. Try to axe me from the show. Forget it. I was right up in there. But the thing that was weird about it was, like, you couldn't see Howdy Doody. You couldn't see anything except, like, all the lights and cameras. And, I mean, it was really weird and kind of semi-disappointing.
Why was it disappointing? Because you couldn't see.
Yeah, just because I didn't realize that there were lights and cameras. And, you know, it's something interesting, like, from that experience, I now kind of, when I meet little kids, you know, out and about, like, for, like, we did the DVD signing the other day here in Manhattan, and 1,000 fans showed up, and I spoke to lots and lots of people, including some kids who would, you know, be just sort of staring at me, and I know enough now to say, like, I don't look like myself, do I, you know, and I look bigger, don't I, and that kind of stuff, because, you know, when you're a kid, like, it didn't occur to me that everything was real life size. You know, I thought Buffalo Bob was like, you know, the size of somebody who could fit inside the TV.
My guest is Paul Rubens. All the episodes of Pee-wee's Playhouse have been released in a DVD box set. Here's another clip from the show.
How do I look, everybody?
You look handsome, Pee-wee.
You look like a world-famous baseball player.
Really? You really think so, Globy?
I bet that's just what I'm going to be.
Ricardo called and told me about the trials that they're going to be having for the Little League team.
Good luck, Pee-wee.
Thanks.
Thanks, Magic Screen.
Of course. With my natural ability, keen eye,
strong throwing arm and running speed,
I doubt if I'll be needing good luck. Wish me luck.
Good luck, Pee-wee.
Play ball!
We'll talk more with Paul Rubens after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Paul Rubens, and he created Pee-wee Herman and played Pee-wee Herman, and now all of the Pee-wee's Playhouse episodes that aired on television are collected on DVD for the first time. You were on The Gong Show before the creation of Pee-wee Herman, and it was a kind of vaudeville type of act. I used to watch The Gong Show, but I don't remember your act. Can you tell us something about the act? And about where it got you? Did you get anything by virtue of having been on The Gong Show?
I did a whole bunch of different acts on The Gong Show, and I think of those times very fondly. I was a big fan of The Gong Show. A woman named Charlotte McGinnis, I went to Boston University for a year before I went to California Institute of the Arts, and I was in the acting school at BU. And when I left after a year, but I kept in touch with a core group of people, and someone who came in the year after I left was this girl who I then met 3 or 4 years later when all the people graduated from BU and they all came out to California. And she had just been on The Gong Show, and I met her, and the first thing she said to me was like, "Do you have any interest in being on The Gong Show? I'm looking for a partner to do something on The Gong Show." And so that was kind of me going, okay, I'll try comedy. I mean, I had done comedy, but I hadn't really been focusing on it. I was much more of a serious actor in the James Dean kind of school. And
that's funny. I mean, because your image is so not that right now.
Well, I had a different image and a different image of myself at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And so she had said, you know, you can join the union after you've been on The Gong Show more than one time. The second time you join the union, which is what she was trying to do, and you get paid. Once you join the union, you get paid for the performance. So I was on The Gong Show about 15 times, and she and I did, we had an act called The Hilarious Betty and Eddie, and we did that on The Gong Show. We won. We won $500, and then they asked us to come back and do it on the nighttime version, which meant I was automatically going to join the union and get paid more money, or get paid, and we won again on the nighttime show. And Artie Johnson said, was one of the judges from Laugh-In, and he said, "What are their names? What are their names again?" And Chuck Barris said, "Betty and Eddie." And he said, "Well, Betty and Eddie, we're going to hear from them in the future." And I literally ran out of the studio and called my parents. I was so excited about it. You know, Artie Johnson recognized us. And being part of this duo act and coming up with material for The Gong Show, then led me into the Groundlings, which was an improvisational group which had a real bent towards writing and character creation. And it was pretty early in my career where I realized, like, no one's going to do this for me, you know, like that I needed to write, that I needed to create my own vehicle and create material. And, you know, anyone who's thinking about this kind of career, I would encourage that, really, because you can wait a long, 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 long time for that, you know, fictional or for that person who's going to come and discover you and go, what's your name? Oh, my God, you know, you're going to be a big star. It just very, very rarely happens like that. So I think, you know, if you're waiting around, you know, you might spend some of that time coming up with some ideas and putting them on a piece of paper.
Paul Rubens, thank you so much for talking with us.
Terry, thank you so much. I really appreciate it, and I had a lot of fun.
Our interview with Paul Rubens was recorded last month. All the episodes of Pee-wee's Playhouse have been released in a new DVD box set. Our end-of-the-year retrospective, Last Laughs, continues tomorrow. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we continue our series Last Laughs, featuring some of our most entertaining interviews of 2004. We'll hear from Cheryl Hines. She plays Larry David's wife on the HBO series Curb Your Enthusiasm. And David Sedaris will talk about his latest bestseller, Dress Your Family in Corduroy and Denim, and he'll read a story from it. Join us for the next Fresh Air.